Today at Reader's Corner, Gary Gallagher, author of The Union War.
They are the embodiment of what made the United States great, that it had a citizenry to render the Union safe. They believed that if democracy failed in the United States, that it might never succeed anywhere in the Western world. And they viewed slaveholders as part of the oligarchic world rather than the part of their democratic world. But for most of the loyal citizenry who embraced emancipation, it had more to do with union than it had to do with black people.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In May of 1865, 145,000 soldiers paraded through Washington's Capitol Mall as part of the Grand Review of the Armies, a two-day celebration marking the end of four grisly years of civil war. The conflict claimed more than 800,000 casualties and forever changed the political landscape. Most importantly, it solidified a young republic that would otherwise have been rent in twain, forever weakened in the eyes of its neighbors. While the war also provided emancipation for the nation's slaves, today's guest Gary Gallagher argues that it was the more abstract idea of union that motivated so many to risk their lives and fortunes. Dr. Gallagher is the author of The Union War, a well-written analysis of the importance of union in the late 19th century, both to the future of the still young nation and to its citizen soldiers. Dr. Gallagher is the John L. Now Professor in the History of the American Civil War at the University of Virginia and one of our nation's leading historians on the Civil War. His books include The Confederate War, Lee and His Generals in War and Memory, and Stephen Dodson Ramseur, Lee's Gallant General. Dr. Gallagher joins us by phone for this interview. Gary Gallagher, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be with you.
So I guess the first question I have to ask, from all the years that I remember learning about Lincoln as the great emancipator, it sounds like after reading your book, I have to call him first and foremost the great unifier, and then maybe the great emancipator.
Well, I think that you might call him first and foremost the president who oversaw a war that guaranteed the viability of the Union and also brought emancipation and got rid of the great incubus of slavery that had bedeviled the nation for so long. But I think preeminently, he would have said it was a war about union. If you don't win the war for union, then emancipation can't come into the picture.
I think I read where the civil rights era may have contributed to this shift of focus from the importance of union as the reason for the Civil War to one of emancipation, because, of course, in the 60s, especially the 60s and the 70s, we were really caught up in the civil rights revolution. And it was natural, I suppose, for historians and others to look upon the Civil War as first and foremost this issue about slavery. I guess my question to you as an historian is it commonplace for historians to have to wrestle in a particular era with how you write history to make sure that you're not just seeing history through the lens of present circumstances and conflicts?
Well, there are about three very big questions buried in the question that you just asked, and I'll try to get to all of them. But the answer to the last one is yes, of course. Every generation writes its history. If that weren't the case, if there were just the history of the Civil War, then there would be the Civil War book. And somebody interested in the Civil War would go read the Civil War book, and they'd know everything they needed to know. And then if they were interested in something else, they'd go read that book. Of course, every generation reinterprets the past to suit its own needs. And the only reason that there are lots of people who do what I do for a living, professional historians who write about some particular part of history, is because the history of anything is constantly changing and being reinterpreted and having different parts drawn out and different parts perhaps muted. That's certainly been the case with the Civil War. So the answer to that part of your question is yes, absolutely. I want to make clear one other thing before we go any further, and that is that there's absolutely no question that issues relating to slavery are what triggered secession and brought the war. That's not my main concern in my book, The Union War, is motivation for the loyal soldiers who fought for the United States. But in terms of what brought the war, it's absolutely slavery. I cannot imagine the Civil War, if you take the issues relating to slavery out of the picture, they're there. And to anyone who argues against that simply isn't looking at the materials from the past. The other part of your question, the more specific one relating to how different eras interpret things, is did the civil rights movement affect how prominent emancipation and African Americans have been in our understanding of the war? And the answer to that is absolutely yes, and it was something that was long, long overdue. People had read about the Civil War basically as if black people didn't exist during the war for many decades. And so this was a very useful corrective that came in the 1960s and 1970s when the field of Civil War history was opened up and African-American participation became much more prominent. I think that an outgrowth of that is that the importance of union has been somewhat lost. I don't think union, in terms of what the concept meant to people in the mid-19th century, has any meaning in the United States now. I think it's literally without meaning in terms of how they understood it in the mid-19th century. And if you don't understand union and the power of the concept in the word, you have no chance of understanding the American Civil War. You don't have a poor chance. You have no chance.
Well, let's get right to that, because that's really what I took away from your book, The Union War. You helped me understand that, and it was a bit of a surprise, because I just hadn't thought about that era carefully enough outside the war itself. Help us with this description of union, and what did union mean in the mid-19th century to these citizens who were soon to become soldiers?
It meant a very great deal, and the people I write about in this book are the ones I call the loyal citizenry of the United States. That is, the population in the free states and the four slaveholding states that stayed in the United States, Missouri and Kentucky and Maryland and Delaware. What did they think the war was about? What did they think it was worth risking their lives for? One of the hardest things for anyone who teaches the Civil War to explain, I've found this over many years, whether talking to students or to groups of adults, is why would a farmer in New Hampshire or Wisconsin or Minnesota or Illinois put on a uniform and risk his life when there was almost no chance that the war was actually going to get anywhere near where they lived? What was it? Why would they do this? And the answer to that for these citizen soldiers, the majority of whom were volunteers, people need to remember that. The American Civil War was fought by volunteers for the most part. A majority of United States soldiers went into uniform before there was conscription. A majority of Confederate soldiers went into uniform before there was conscription. The Union soldiers fought for union, and what it meant to them was a very powerful array of ideas tied to the founding generation, tied to the work of the American patriots, as they would have put it, who wrote the Constitution and won the Revolutionary War against Great Britain, established independence. What they did was establish a republic that offered ordinary citizens the right to have a voice in their government, a direct voice in their government, and the opportunity, not the guarantee, but the opportunity to rise financially. That was unique in the world, they believed. And they had a very, very exceptionalist view of the United States, and they were right. The United States was by far the most democratic, small-d democratic nation in the Western world, by far, none even close, including Great Britain. And it was the place that had by far the most economic opportunity of any place in the Western world. You weren't doomed to be what your father was in the United States. That was a theme played over and over and over, not just in the writings of Abraham Lincoln and other leaders, but also the common soldiers. And Lincoln, of course, was a poster boy for this. Where else could you get Abraham Lincoln at the head of a nation, someone who was born absolutely hard scrabble in the backwoods, almost no formal education, and yet he could become a successful lawyer and eventually president of the United States? That couldn't happen anywhere else, they believed. And they believed that a tremendous threat to the future of this small-d democratic society with opportunity was what they considered an oligarchic slaveholding class in the South who didn't believe in democracy, who threatened this great promise in the Western world of a democratic society. They believed that if democracy failed in the United States, that it might never succeed anywhere in the Western world. They'd watched the revolutions of the late 1840s in Europe, and in all of those instances, forces of democracy had failed. Oligarchy seemed more powerful, aristocracy, monarchy, and they viewed slaveholders as part of that world, the oligarchic world, rather than the part of their democratic world.
So where does this average American get his or her information in the mid-19th century? I mean, there's an assumption here that even though Americans may not have been well-educated as we define the term today, I think you point out that they followed the war closely, and there was this, at least some kind of a news feed, very different than 24-hour cable cycle and social media that we have today. But folks were developing this concept of liberty, this understanding of the founding of the Republic. How does this happen back then?
Well, it happened. I think in some ways they were better educated than we are as a society. In the free states, there was public education. That overwhelmingly people were literate, both in the South and in the North, white people, but overwhelmingly in the North. They got these things from school. They got them from newspapers, which were very, very widely read and disseminated. And there were certain concepts that came down to them, concepts from the American Revolutionary era. And the rhetoric of Daniel Webster, for example, and his great speech about liberty and union and what that meant. I mean, that speech was printed in very large numbers, disseminated very widely, and it had become, literally become, part of the culture by the 1850s and later. That notion of tying liberty and what they meant by liberty there, this is something we have to be very careful about now. When they said liberty, they're not thinking, for the most part, of slavery and emancipation. They're thinking of liberty in the sense of the founding documents that provided political liberty for white men. I mean, it's a restricted liberty in our view. Women couldn't vote. Black people, for the most part, couldn't vote. It's a restricted franchise by our view, but within their context, it's a very broad one, and it's that liberty to have a voice in your government and to make your way economically. You can't stress that too much. Lincoln talked about it a lot. Many people talked about it a lot, that this was the only place in the world, the United States, where you had that kind of liberty, both political liberty and economic liberty. And these are ideas that would have been percolating in the culture very, very broadly through all of the decades leading down to the Civil War.
Part of your answer reminds me of my days back in Illinois when I visited all the sites of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and when we try to understand how well our voters today are informed of the issues, I always point out to my friends that those debates were anywhere from 2 to 3 hours in length. They were long discourses by both of the candidates. They were attended by a few thousand people who would gather in those small towns across Illinois in weather that was usually very hot, and it's a pretty good point about what you're saying regarding the fact that it's not as though folks didn't know what was going on back then.
They didn't think in terms of sound bites then. They actually read things that might take more than 2 minutes to read and think about them and discuss them. Politics was very much a part of American life. Much discussed in any number of forums, and they just had a better sense, I think, of what was going on in many ways than we do now. They were extremely partisan, of course. I'm amused now when the kind of demented 24-hour news cycle pretends that things are different now than they've ever been. We've never been as divided as we are now. The two parties have never been so much at odds. It's the only way you can believe that is if you don't know anything. If your historical memory goes back to Tuesday, then you could believe that. But if you know anything about the past, you know that's not true. Just absolutely not true.
You're listening to Gary Gallagher. He is the author of The Union War. Let's drill down on this issue of the majority of Northerners who signed up for the war to become citizen soldiers. They were prejudiced. I mean, there's no doubt about it that they were, at least a fairly good number of them, were prejudiced toward blacks.
So, a fairly good number of them. By our standards, all of them.
All, right.
I mean, nothing's easier than judging people in the past by our own standards, but they absolutely were racist by our standards. There was a spectrum. Was Lincoln racist by our standards? Yes. Would he have been on the virulently racist end of the scale in the mid-ninth century? No, he would not. But yes, they were racist. It's just a fact. It's very important to separate racial views and views about emancipation. You could be anti-slavery and still be racist. Those are separate things. They're tied, of course, but they're not the same thing. Attitudes toward race, attitudes toward slavery can be different. Most of these citizen soldiers eventually accepted emancipation as necessary. So they came to support emancipation, but not for the reasons that we would want. They didn't embrace it as a great moral imperative to get rid of this monstrous institution that had been in place since the beginning of the nation. They supported getting rid of it for three basic and important reasons. Number one, that it would help win the war. It would help destroy the rebellion, which would keep the Union intact. Second, it would punish the oligarchic slaveholders. What's the best way to punish a slaveholder? Take slaves away from them. And that's what doing this would accomplish. And the third thing that it would accomplish, it would remove going forward the one issue that most people at the time believed was powerful enough to threaten the integrity of the Union from within. If there's no slavery, they believed, the aftermath of the war would be a time when the nation, the integrity of the nation, of the Union, would not have been threatened from within. All of those reasons to embrace emancipation have to do with Union, not preeminently to do with black people and the institution of slavery. There's always a percentage that would have said slavery is the most important thing to get rid of, abolitionists, black and white, and some others. Maybe, there's no way to tell, maybe 10% of the population, of the white population, at the very most. But for most of the loyal citizenry who embraced emancipation, it had more to do with Union than it had to do with black people.
So as the Union soldiers were making their way through the South and having these decisive victories, slaves were freed and became contraband. Help us understand what that term contraband meant back then and how slaves, freed slaves, then were treated and what they did in the course of the conflict.
Well, the term contraband came from a Union officer named Benjamin Franklin Butler, who was a politician from Massachusetts who became a soldier for the United States. And it came very, very early in the war. In the spring of 1861, he was in command at Fort Monroe, down on the tip of what's called the peninsula in Virginia, down near Norfolk, Virginia. And three enslaved men, black men, made their way to Union lines, to Butler's lines. And Butler said that under international law, you could seize contraband of war, the definition of contraband being anything that would directly assist your enemy's war effort. He said that black labor was essential to the Confederate war effort, and therefore he could retain these three black men in Union lines by denominating them contraband of war. And that label stuck, both in the United States and the Confederacy throughout the war. Black people who made their way to Union lines became known as contrabands. And as the war went along, wherever United States armies went, black people made their way toward Union lines. It was a wide-scale phenomenon. It was very similar to earlier wars during the American Revolution. Wherever the British army went, enslaved people would make their way toward the British army as well. Wars are very disruptive to slaveholding societies. That was the case in the American Civil War. And Union armies, even before the Emancipation Proclamation, even before congressional legislation, became these great disruptive agents inside the slaveholding South. And in the end, these great engines of emancipation, even if many of the men, and including the officers in charge, didn't care that much about emancipation. It was simply the fact of the presence of these United States armies that made it possible for black people to make the very risky and difficult decision to try to make their way to freedom. Now, in the end, there were 3.5 million enslaved people in the Confederacy. The best guess is that about 1 in 7 had achieved freedom by the end of the war, about 500,000. 3 million still remained enslaved, even at the time of Appomattox, especially in places where the U.S. Army had never penetrated, places such as Texas.
So how many of those freed or escaped slaves wound up actually in battalions as black soldiers fighting for the North?
About 200,000 black men served in the United States Army during the war. They made up about 9% of all the men in the U.S. Army, and they came overwhelmingly from states that bordered the Mississippi River. They were not treated equally for much of the war. It's a very sad story. They served in segregated units, of course. The U.S. Army was segregated until Harry Truman integrated it after World War II. The film Glory is really, it does a very good job. It has little problems, but for the most part, it conveys a good sense of African-American service during the war in the most famous of the black units, 54th Massachusetts.
I mentioned the grand review of the armies. I was really delighted to learn of this two-day pageantry to celebrate the end of the war.
Right.
Help us understand what that was like for the average parade goer who shows up in Washington, D.C. to watch this. And then the second part of the question is, there was an absence of black troops in that parade, and I think you have an explanation for that as well.
Well, yes, it was a parade that was done, although it was a massive parade, it was really put together at the very last minute. Even William Tecumseh Sherman wasn't sure until just a very few days before the parade that there was going to be a parade. And the units that participated in the parade were the ones who happened to be near Washington, and they were most of the Army, the Potomac, and Sherman's armies that had been operating in Georgia and the Carolinas. Those are the forces that paraded. The Eastern soldiers paraded one day. The Western soldiers of Sherman paraded the other day. There were no black units near Washington then. Most of the black units were in one infantry corps, and they were in process of being sent down toward the Texas border because there was still a looming threat with French troops in Texas, and the United States wanted to make a gesture there. But the main thing is there weren't any black soldiers near Washington, and so they didn't get to be in the parade, just as scores of thousands of white soldiers didn't get to be in the parade because they weren't in Washington either.
For decades following the war, the veterans were revered for their loyalty and sacrifice. Was this the same kind of recognition and reverence that we offer veterans today, and were the black veterans included in that?
The black veterans were included in that. Military service, I mean, the literature scholars have written differently about this. This is one of the things that they have written differently about. I think there's been a good degree of exaggeration about how white veterans shunned black veterans after the war. There's a recent book by a scholar named Barbara Gannon that really puts the lie to that. White soldiers respected the service that black soldiers had put in. There were white and black veterans in the Grand Army of the Republic, which was the major Union veterans organization after the war. Veterans were a very powerful symbol after the war. As citizen soldiers, some scholars have treated the Grand Review as this great militaristic display. They miss the point entirely. It's a great display of military power, but what the people who watched that parade talked about most was that those marching men were not professional soldiers. They were citizen soldiers who had done their small R Republican duty in the tradition of George Washington and the Continental soldiers. They'd done their duty. The very thing they wanted most was not to be soldiers anymore. They're the antithesis of professional soldiers, and they are the embodiment of what made the United States great, that it had a citizenry that in a crisis would do its citizens' obligation to render the Union safe. That is what people talked most about that, and of course, after the war, they remain symbolic in that way. There were no national cemeteries before the Civil War. Our national cemetery system comes because they needed a place to bury a third of a million dead United States soldiers. Those cemeteries became sites of commemoration where people remember the service of these citizen soldiers. Decoration Day, as they called it, we now call it Memorial Day, that came as a result of the Civil War, too, and that is to commemorate the service of these citizen soldiers.
You talk about the citizen soldier, and there's no doubt throughout your book that you have such a command of the average American's take on living in America in the 19th century, on the Civil War and its aftermath. Do your sources differ from those we might find in the treatments of academic historians? I mean, I know you are an academic historian.
Everybody uses the same sources.
Yeah, I mean, help us understand where you go to get this stuff. I mean, it's an amazing array of materials that you've brought forth here to get into the minds and hearts of the American people who lived on this planet in the 19th century in America.
Well, the thing is to, I mean, I triangulated among different kinds of evidence. I used soldiers' letters and diaries. I read every issue of the two major illustrated newspapers in the United States, Harper's Weekly and Frank Leslie's Illustrated Newspaper. I looked at material culture, for example, the envelopes that people used to mail their letters. There were millions and millions of letters sent from the Army and to the Army, of course, and companies made patriotic envelopes that had slogans and pictures on them. Oh, I looked at several thousand of those to see what messages there were, and the overwhelmingly most important message was Union. Virtually nothing relating to emancipation on those patriotic covers. Union everywhere on those covers. I also looked at unit histories, that is, histories of United States regiments that were written in the immediate aftermath of the war. No one had ever really looked at those before with an eye toward what I was doing. And once again, Union is just the overwhelming theme there. They were in a mood, a retrospective mood. They mostly came out in 1865 and 1866. And I wondered what they would talk about as the most important thing of the war. And what they talked about was the maintenance of the Union.
And you claim that it was the armies, not necessarily the statement of emancipation proclamation that really freed the slaves. Explain how that works.
Well, I think that the emancipation was a process, and there were many contributors. Congress contributed. Lincoln certainly contributed. African Americans on the ground contributed. My point is that in the absence of the presence of United States armies, it doesn't matter how much Lincoln wants to get rid of slavery, or how much black people want to be free, or how much abolitionists in Congress want to get rid of slavery. Slavery will not be gotten rid of unless the United States Army projects power into the Confederacy in a way that disrupts the institution. You can map the landscape of freedom almost precisely by where the United States armies go. There's a great letter that Robert Gould Shaw, who was the commander of the 54th Massachusetts, he was in a different unit earlier in the war, and in the wake of Antietam, when Lincoln issued his preliminary proclamation, his mother wrote to him. She was an abolitionist, and she sort of chided him for not being more excited about Lincoln's preliminary proclamation. He said, no, that's fine. It should have come earlier, but he said, it really doesn't make any difference. I'm paraphrasing him here. He said, because where our army goes, there is no slavery, and where our army doesn't go, slavery is untouched. And that is really the heart of the process of emancipation in my reading. If the U.S. Army isn't there, emancipation doesn't happen.
Well, Gary, we've run out of time, but the good news for our listeners is that you are coming to Boise on October 25th. You will be speaking at the Andrus Center for Public Policy. The title of the conference is Why the Civil War Still Matters. Once again, thanks so much for the book, The Union War. Gary Gallagher, thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
I had fun.
Next week, Susan Orlean, author of Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.